be available at the table.
The EU created a sanctions programme last year to punish what it calls unauthorised exploration in the eastern Mediterranean Sea, freezing assets of people and companies accused of planning or participating in activities in Cyprus's exclusive economic zone or on its continental shelf. Only senior officials of Turkey's state-owned Turkish Petroleum Corporation were put on the sanctions list, but that was not enough for Greece. It is a delicate situation for Germany, having to mediate between two NATO members, Ankara and Athens, without seeming to have divided loyalties. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Government leaders meeting in Brussels have adopted proposals aimed at trying to avert chaos at EU-UK borders in the event that Britain abruptly exits the bloc's rules and regulations at the end of this month when the Brexit transition period ends on the 31st of December. This, as floundering trade talks between both sides continue.
No one understates the challenges that lie ahead, but it's important for the citizens of Europe that we do everything we possibly can to get agreement here.
France has made it clear it will veto any EU-UK trade agreement that does not safeguard the livelihoods of those involved in the French fishing industry. The big sticking point for Germany is ensuring that British firms do not have unfair advantage over EU firms, for example, via state subsidies. Hardline Brexiteers do not want to see a deal as they are worried this would align the UK too closely to the EU. Equally, there are many people in the European Union who adjudge London to be extremely arrogant. This cohort does not want to see a deal as they'd rather look on as Britain faces the full consequences of Brexit. Those consequences might include very restricted travel to the EU from the UK from January the 1st due to the 27-nation bloc's COVID-19 rules with respect to non-members. British citizens living in the EU would likely face all sorts of bureaucracy. Then, of course, there are warnings of dire economic consequences for the UK and possibly Scottish independence. We are told the key to securing a EU-UK future relationship agreement to avoid chaos in January is fairness.
This fine balance of fairness has not been achieved so far. Our negotiators are still working and we will take a decision on Sunday.
Even in the absence of a trade deal with the UK, EU leaders know they already face many economic challenges.
We still haven't fully resolved the problems of very high public debt, private debt still very high, banking sector problems still very present, price adjustments still ongoing.
The prospects aren't looking good. As EU leaders continued their meeting in the Belgian capital, British Prime Minister Boris Johnson stated there is a, quote, strong possibility a trade deal will not be reached. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
The administration of US President Donald Trump is given the go-ahead to sell billions of dollars worth of arms to the UAE. On Wednesday, the Republican-led US Senate approved the deal proposed by the government. The contract, reportedly worth some $23 billion, includes the sales of the U.S.'s most advanced F-35 fighter jets and Reaper drones. Senators voted almost along party lines on two resolutions. All but two Democrats voted to block the deal, while one Republican broke ranks to vote against the sale. Trump had issued a formal threat to veto congressional efforts to block the weapons transfer. Those in favor of the deal described the UAE as an important U.S. partner in West Asia. Detractors, on the other hand, argued the UAE should not be armed with advanced weapons given its involvement in the war on Yemen. They also warned that such a move would ignite an arms race in the region. A couple of months ago, in a controversial move, the UAE normalized its relations with Israel. The country trampled upon years of at least verbal commitment to the Palestinian cause by recognizing Israel. It also distanced itself from the majority of the Arab countries that have no diplomatic relations with Israel over the regime's occupation of Palestinian lands. The UAE's recognition of Israel was said to be a precondition for its purchase of advanced weaponry from the United States. Therefore, F-35 jets and Reaper drones can be considered the payoff for turning their back to Palestinians. The United Arab Emirates, which is ruled by monarchs, has a bleak human rights record. The country is a staunch Saudi ally, the two of which have been leading a devastating war in Yemen since March 2015. The war has killed thousands of innocent Yemenis, including women and children, and has caused what the UN describes as the world's worst humanitarian crisis. The UAE also openly supported anti-government militants in Syria, exacerbating the suffering of the Syrian people by fueling the bloodshed in the Arab country. It has also been actively engaged in a brutal suppression of a popular pro-democracy movement in neighboring Bahrain. Abu Dhabi is now eyeing to seize control of southern Yemen, including a strategic island there, using its proxies.
Iran and Afghanistan have launched a railway that connects the Iranian northeastern city of Khaf to Herat in the other country. Iran's President Hassan Rouhani and his Afghan counterpart Ashraf Ghani attended the inauguration ceremony through video conference due to the global corona epidemic. The two sides said the project is a pivotal one that helps boost bilateral economic ties and collaborations.
With the completion of such an important project, the commodities of your businessmen could easily be transferred to Europe. With this railway, you can have access to Iran's southern ports, including Imam Khomeini port and Bandar Abbas, and later on to Chabahar.
For his part, the Afghan president also said that the important project will give fresh momentum to economic ties between the two countries.
We jointly put iron on earth and soil to tie the destiny of the two nations to outline our future collaborations. I offer congratulations and wish the best for the two nations and governments.
The railway is about 140 kilometers long, and after being connected to Herat, it will be about 225 kilometers.
The Khaf-Herat Railway will enhance economic, cultural, and social exchanges between the two countries. It will see over 6 million tons of goods transported annually. It will also link Afghanistan through Iran to the Caspian Sea, Russia, and Europe. Human Abedi, Tehran.
The news that people in the United Kingdom are already getting the COVID-19 vaccine has given hope to millions of families across the globe. Families with elderly or vulnerable members are wondering when it will be their turn. According to the People's Vaccine Alliance, which includes Amnesty International and Oxfam, it might be a while. The organization says rich countries are hoarding the most promising vaccines, just as they did during the swine flu pandemic in 2009. Moderna and Pfizer-BioNTech have so far sold out, despite promises of fair distribution.
We set out at the beginning to deliver this vaccine to the world, and that means fair allocations across all countries that wish to use our, have our vaccine. So no, not all of the doses that we produce go to the UK. The UK gets, like every country, a fair proportion.
Rich countries have bought more than half the globe's supply of vaccines. That means 1 in 10 people in at least 67 poor countries will not get it unless urgent action is taken. This contradicts statements made by rich nations at the UN after General Secretary Antonio Guterres called on them to make vaccines available to all.
France proposes a donation mechanism so that a portion of the first doses of vaccines available are used to vaccinate priority groups in developing countries.
To end this pandemic anywhere, we have to end it everywhere. We need a united global effort that ensures that everyone has equitable access to a potential vaccine.
Experts say this is blatantly hypocritical, though. Canada has purchased enough vaccines to immunize its entire population five times over. The same goes for the world's highest per capita buyer, the United Kingdom. Meanwhile, countries that are subject to US-led sanctions are being prevented from purchasing the vaccine. Iran is one of them. The US has imposed crippling sanctions on its banking sector and its vital oil and gas industry, and threatened punitive measures against any country or company that does business with Iran.
The pandemic has shown what humanity is capable of at its best and worst. Inspiring acts of compassion and self-sacrifice, breathtaking feats of science and innovation, and heartwarming demonstrations of solidarity. But also disturbing signs of self-interest blame shifting and division.
The UN is calling for a global ceasefire, debt relief for struggling nations, and a lifting of sanctions amid the COVID-19 pandemic. But it seems these calls have so far fallen on deaf ears. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan criticized U.S. administration's comments and actions against Turkish arms deal with Russia. In a presser, Erdogan, however, said he would discuss Turkish-U.S. relations with the next president once he takes office, just like it was the case before.
Once he assumes office, we will surely sit down and discuss certain things with Mr. Biden, just like we sat down and talked in the United States or Turkey in the past. We will discuss these again. We do not find the statements and actions they make regarding our arms procurements to be nice. We especially don't find their approach in northern Syria to be right.
Turkey and the U.S. ties have been hit by Turkey's purchase of S-400 missiles from Russia after the U.S. was unable to seal a deal on Patriot missiles. Despite the ongoing tensions and sanction threats, everyone could see the chemistry between Erdogan and Trump. The chemistry that Erdogan-Biden relation is definitely not going to have. Analysts worry about the future of relations between Ankara and Washington.
Turkish President's statement on Turkish-U.S. relations is aimed to build a good relation with Washington, especially now that Joe Biden will take office. However, it is not guaranteed that things will go well due to differences between the two allies. The U.S. still insists on its support to Kurdish militants and tries to impose its strategies on Turkey, which is not acceptable for the government here. Therefore, I think tensions will continue to escalate between the two states.
The tension between the two NATO allies goes back to 2003, when Ankara refused to permit U.S. troops to cross its borders to Iraq. The tensions escalated due to different views on the Syrian crisis and Turkey's purchase of S-400 from Russia. Despite the ongoing tensions, many believe that both Ankara and Washington need each other's support in different arenas. This will force Erdogan and Biden to talk things out. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a speech delivered on November 3, 2020 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, via video conference on the occasion of the birthday anniversaries of the Holy Prophet of Islam and Imam Jafar Sadiq, greetings be upon them, and which coincides this year with the National Day of Fighting Against Global Arrogance and Unity Week.
We were not the ones who started the fight. It was not the case that we began the confrontation. In the Holy Quran, too, there is an ayah in this regard. They took aggression by being the first to assault you. Chapter 9, verse 13. They were the ones to start the fight. We did not attack the embassy just after the revolution. In the beginning of the revolution, the U.S. embassy was busy working, but they began to move against the revolution by issuing resolutions and delivering speeches in the Congress against the newly born Islamic Republic. They also created terrorist and seditionist groups, and they devised schemes against us. Inside the embassy, too, which was correctly called the Den of Espionage, they created a big espionage network. So, it was they who began the fight. the students' movement, an attack on the embassy was in fact a defensive move, which was made in a timely, correct, and completely reasonable fashion.
Your light and love, all I see, nothing more I'd ever want to need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor, grant me faith to be stronger.
And I wish to add that the notion that some people have about the U.S. government and regime is a wrong notion. They think if a government surrenders to that regime, it will benefit from it. But this is not the case. In the case of those governments that have relations with the U.S. and that are in better conditions, the reason is that they have not surrendered to it. Of course, they will receive blows in accordance with the size of their relations with the U.S. Those governments which gave in to the U.S., which accepted its policies and which surrendered to its bullying, have received blows. An example in this regard is Camp David. The backwardness that they suffered because of it will last 30, 40 years. Another example is the Pahlavi regime in our own country. They really made the country lag behind because of their surrender to U.S. policies. With the passage of every day, such regimes will become more and more dependent and will face more problems.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
Hi, good morning.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning.
Morning, sir.
Half a kilo of Halim, please. Kitty, good morning.
Number one, hands up. Number two, hands on the waist.
Hi, good morning.
Hi, good morning.
Get ready for jogging to warm up.
Hello, good morning.
Hello, good morning.
One loaf of well-baked bread, please.
the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who allowed none to witness when He created the heavens and the earth, and who took no helper when He authored the spirits. He has no associate in divinity and no support in unity. Tongues fall silent before the limits of describing Him. Intellects fail before the core of knowing Him. Terrors fall low in awe of Him. Faces are humbled in fear of Him. And everything mighty yields to His mightiness. So to Thee belongs praise again and again, well measured, continually and methodically. And may His blessings be upon His messenger endlessly, and His salutation everlastingly, eternally. O Allah, make the beginning of this day of mine righteousness, its middle prosperity, and its end success. I seek refuge in Thee from a day whose beginning is fright, and whose middle is anxiety, and whose end is pain. O Allah, I pray forgiveness from Thee for every vow I have vowed, and every promise I have promised, and every pledge I have pledged, then failed to keep for Thee. I ask Thee concerning the complaints of Thy servants against me. If there is a servant from among Thy servants, of a handmaid from among Thy handmaids, who has against me a complaint, because I have wronged him in respect to himself, his reputation, his property, his wife or his child, or because evil words I have spoken about him in his absence, an imposition upon him through inclination, caprice, scorn, zeal, false show, bigotry, whether he be absent or present, alive or dead, such that my hand has fallen short and my capacity has been too narrow to make restitution to him or to annul my obligation to him, I ask Thee, O He who owns all objects of need, which are granted by His will and hastened to His desire, that Thou blessest Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, peace be upon them, and makest the one I have wronged satisfied with me in the manner that Thou willst, and givest me mercy from Thee. Forgiveness decreases Thee not, and giving injuries Thee not. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, give me on every Monday two favors from Thee: the facility to obey Thee at its beginning, and the favor of Thy forgiveness at its end. O He who is Allah, and none other than whom grants forgiveness for sins.
The debate.
According to the International Criminal Court, it has confirmed that there is a reasonable basis to believe that members of the British Armed Forces committed the war crimes of willful killing, torture, inhumane cruel treatment, outrages upon personal dignity, and rape and or other forms of sexual violence. And what do you think the ICC did when they found out this information? They closed the case. That's right. We will be taking a look at Western privilege in the international arena and the lack of accountabilities for lives lost or destroyed in developing countries. In this debate, this hour, I'd like to welcome to the program out of London, Press TV's Richard Sudan, and out in Edinburgh, author and commentator John White. Thank you both for being with us. Starting it off with Richard. Well, Richard, tell me about what's being said on that side of things. It is quite curious that after admitting that there were war crimes committed, that the ICC then closed the case.
I mean, I think, Marzia, in your introduction, you mentioned the phrase Western privilege, and I think that's a really good starting point. I mean, frankly, there are going to be scores of human rights lawyers and experts, scores of anti-war activists that are going to be looking at the decision by the chief prosecutor who said there's no case for the British to answer to with utter disbelief, because in spite of all of the accounts, all of the testimony, all of the evidence that's been put forward, really, in addition to what we already knew, it seems something that, on the one hand, there's been some sort of admission that the British Army military command did indeed contribute to suspected war crimes committed against the Iraqi detainees. But on the other hand, I think the decision mentioned that it's satisfied that the British authorities conducted their own investigation. On what planet, amid what semblance of fairness and true democracy, can the party which is being accused of committing the war crimes somehow be the vindicator that there were none committed? It beggars belief, and I suspect the international community is really looking at this decision with a kind of side-eye squint, also in a sense of disbelief, as are much of the British people.
All right. Well, John, let me get you in on this conversation. What do you make of this? How is that from a legal perspective? I mean, how does it make sense? So there is a court. The court says, yes, we see proof of war crimes being taken out and that's taken place, and yet the case is closed. And what type of signal, what message does this basically send to the world?
Well, good evening, Amina, and good evening, Richard. There are times when the truth is not enough and when only the unvarnished truth will do. And when we come to an unvarnished truth of this development, let us be honest, this is not about Western privilege per se, this is about white supremacy. The problem disfiguring our world today is not the lack of democracy within states, it's the lack of democracy between states. And this merely confirms it, because what we have are a clutch of Western imperialist countries, of which the UK is a prime member, who do not see themselves as upholders of international laws, but arbiters of international laws, which means to say they get to decide what constitutes war crimes and what does not. And in this case, what we're seeing is the white supremacy of the British imperial state at work. Its soldiers can never be accused or prosecuted for committing war crimes. Because why? Because they're on the good side in this eternal war against the black and brown other. No ifs, no buts, no maybes.
Let me also welcome our next guest. Now, out of London, author and political commentator, Jonathan Fryer. Jonathan, thanks so much for being with us. Now, Jonathan, the reason the ICC says it is dismissing this is because the UK is investigating itself. Your take on what exactly that means?
Well, there have really been two stages to the British investigation. For several years up until 2017, was something called the Iraq Historic Allegations Team, or IHAT. And they had legal teams in court which listened to the claims of people from Iraq who said that they had been tortured or mistreated in various ways. And there were well over 3,000 such claims. And although 70% were dismissed as perhaps unreliable, that still meant that hundreds of people had got legitimate claims. But in fact, the cases fell apart because of the evidence not being strong enough. And instead, what's happened is that now the British military themselves are looking into any prolonged appeals. And it was interesting that the ICC, in its judgment in abandoning the case, now has said that they did believe that the British military were looking at this. But of course, for the victims and their families, there is no justice in this.
Well, now, John, do you think that for international organizations such as the ICC, that the value of lives differ depending on the part of the world one is from?
Oh, indeed, yes. We live in a world underpinned by the values of might is right rather than right is might. And the IEC in this decision has proven itself to be unfit for purpose. We need to move beyond this idea that a certain group of countries based on military might and economic power have the right to determine what is just and what is not just. If these were Iranian troops, if these were Venezuelan troops, if these were Cuban troops involved in these activities or accused of these activities, it would be an entirely different narrative. This is about imperialism, no ifs, no buts. And I just have to say this. I am appalled as a citizen of the United Kingdom how dehumanized people of Iraq, of Syria, of Iran have been treated in terms of their value. And they have been pushed outside the circle of human worth that is established in the name of Western imperialism. And this is a very, very sordid and squalid turn of events. And I hope many people in the West will finally wake up to the injustice and the barbarism and the cruelty that has been perpetuated in their name. And unless they do, the world is headed for perdition. This is nothing more than imperial power writ large. There is no justice here. There is no legal pretext here. It's all about power. And until we move beyond that and move into a world where it's about underpinned by justice, regardless of country, regardless of culture, then, I foresee that we're headed for a very bad end.
Jonathan, ICC prosecutor Fatou Bensouda says that the UK has been using mechanisms to investigate itself, but then admits that this 10-year investigation has not led to anyone being convicted. It's quite amazing that on the one hand, she's saying that they are capable of actually judging themselves, but on the other hand, no one has been convicted and paid a price. So as our other guest said, would it be the same thing if we were talking about another country such as Iran or, as he said, Venezuela?
Well, it might well be different in those cases. One can't know unless a particular case comes before. As I mentioned earlier, the problem was in the case of British soldiers in Iraq that the evidence was not strong enough linked to individual soldiers or commanders that would actually enable anybody to be successful.
Jonathan, who determined that the evidence was not strong enough? The ICC?
The ICC accepted what the British had, British government and British military had decided through the Iraqi
scheme.
And that what we have a situation, though, I think we have to admit, and probably John would agree with me on this, is that the real problem is the whole idea of European or North American countries intervening in a situation such as Iraq. Many millions of people, including myself in Britain, demonstrated against the Iraq war and thought it was a terrible mistake. And those sorts of interventions in countries that have a completely different culture and ethnicity and so on almost inevitably lead to various types of abuses. And this is something which I think has to be approached, and I would say in two ways. First of all, that these sorts of interventions should not be entered into as lightly as they have in the past. And secondly, the rules of engagement need to be much more closely monitored so that people are not able to commit the sort of abuses which undoubtedly happened in the case
of
Iraq.
Jonathan, you're just jumping in here, listening to what you're saying, but at the end of the day, you say that they should not, these countries like the UK, should not be involved or not get involved very easily or lightly in these regions. But of course they do. And on the other hand, the ones who are paying the price are the people of this region, not the aggressors, not the ones that are coming in. At the end of the day, if we're looking at, for example, Iraq, that millions of people have been displaced. That country has never gone back to the where it was prior to the war. Yes, Saddam Hussein is gone, but so is security and so many other things. And so many people have been tortured, and so much abuse has taken place. So then the question is, so who pays? Who pays? We're looking right now at the ICC saying, well, the Brits are going to investigate themselves, but these were the same ones, based on a lie, who went into the country to begin with, that they had no right to go into, because, of course, we know now that there were no weapons of mass destruction.
Well, I agree, Marzia, absolutely, that the intervention in 2003 was not only unjustified, but as many of us would believe, totally illegal. But we have a situation when you say who is going to pay for what has happened in Iraq, and it is a tragic case. It is unfortunately many of the individual citizens and the communities in Iraq who are paying the price, and it's a terribly high price, which is why there needs to be a complete rethink, as I said, of engagement in foreign wars and foreign interventions.
Okay. Let me get John. Jonathan. Let me get John back in on this. Yeah. John, do you think that this verdict from the ICC prosecutor Fatou Bensouda is connected at all to what happened back in September, when Bensouda and the ICC ruled that there was enough evidence to investigate the U.S. for war crimes in Afghanistan, and after that ruling, the U.S. sanctioned her? Do you see any type of connection that perhaps there are threats, intimidation being exerted on her? Your thoughts on that side of things?
Well, there's absolutely a connection here. I mean, about just need to go back to something Jonathan said. Jonathan Fry is somebody that I hold in the highest esteem, but I must take exception to his description of the war in Iraq as a mistake. Nomenclature is very important before it unlocks the keys to human consciousness. This war was not a mistake, it was a crime. It was a war crime, it was an atrocity. And the problem that we have in British culture is that every war since the Second World War is perceived and is presented as a rerun of the Second World War, i.e. the good war, i.e. that we are the good guys in this war, and that who we are up against are the bad guys. Saddam's Hitler, Rouhani's Hitler, Maduro's Hitler, Castro's Hitler. Do you understand the pattern here? This is national myth presented to the British public as reality. We are the good guys, we are never the bad guys, and our troops can never commit atrocities. Until we break free from these shackles of false consciousness, then I say the world will always be in a perennial state of destabilization, of chaos, of mayhem, and of huge human suffering. Peoples of the global south cannot afford our propaganda any longer, because it has been the result, it has been the product of their unremitting suffering. We must bring this to an end, and it's incumbent on people like me and Jonathan to be people in the West, in Britain, to make that case unremittingly, regardless of the personal cost to us and our careers.
Well, Jonathan, when the U.S. treats an international organization in the way that Washington treated the ICC, doesn't it show the lack of sovereignty and legitimacy that perhaps the ICC has to begin with?
Well, of course, the United States and its behavior is a particular case, which one shouldn't generalize with other countries necessarily in Europe. The United States has never been shy of putting pressure on other countries or institutions such as the ICC, and as you know, it refused to engage with the ICC and has withdrawn from other international treaties and organizations because it refuses to accept the universal nature of international law and the rule of law. And as we've seen with the policy towards Iran, of course, and with maximum pressure under the Trump administration. They are prepared in Washington not only to put pressure from America, but also to coerce other countries to try to get them to follow suit. One hopes this situation will change over the coming months, and certainly there is great resistance amongst many European countries into being coerced in that way, and there's great support for the work of the ICC amongst most European member states.
Well, John, the majority of cases prosecuted by the ICC deal with African countries. This seems to hint at the high level of abuse which has been committed by African leaders. However, if we look at the number of people killed and affected in Afghanistan and Iraq by the U.S.-led coalition, one would assume that countries such as the U.K. and the U.S. should be at the top of the agenda of ICC for investigating and prosecuting war crimes. Your thoughts?
Well, Malcolm X said it best, Amina. If you don't understand what's going on in the Congo, you can't understand what's going on in Mississippi. There is a circular relationship between the social and economic injustice taking place in Western countries and the foreign policy of imperialism, colonialism, and oppression that is underway perennially by those same Western countries. And people who are the victims of oppression in those Western countries, until they wake up to the reality of their condition and their whys and wherefores, then there will never be freedom for the rest of the world. And I just hope and pray that people in the US, people, the 40 million who lack healthcare, the families of the over 200,000 who have died from COVID, the families of the over 60,000 who have died from COVID in the UK, they wake up to the reality and move beyond the propaganda, the flag waving, the nationalism, the sense of patriotism. Until they move beyond that, then the world, never mind themselves, but the world will not be free. And I look forward to that day happening soon. I really do hope so.
Well, we all hope so, that's for sure. But Jonathan, when there is so much inequality in the international arena, even the criminal court, doesn't this send a message to developing countries that they must strengthen themselves militarily because might makes right?
Well, I certainly would agree that developing countries have every reason to be disappointed, to put it mildly, in the way that the ICC has tended to focus on Africa. There have been a few other cases recently which are a little more broad, but I would not particularly want to urge countries to spend their scarce resources on yet more military weapons. One of the problems of developing countries, including in Africa, is that too many governments spend far too much on arms and not enough on making sure that their populations are properly fed and educated. So although I can understand the resentment, I think rushing out to buy more arms is not the answer.
What your thoughts on that, John? Because it seems that that is exactly the signal that is being sent, that you have to be strong militarily, and basically you can get away with anything. Now, what Jonathan said when talking about African countries,
in theory, Jonathan's absolutely correct, but in reality, they have no choice because they're under risk of being invaded. Ask Muammar Gaddafi's ghost if he should have spent more money on arms, if he should have given up his chemical weapons program in 2003 when he did. Ask the people of Iraq. Ask the people of Iran who are suffering under these barbaric sanctions if they think their country should spend less on arms in order to put up a deterrence against the vultures that are circling their country right now. Look, this is all about racism. It's racism writ large. It's colonialism, it's imperialism in our time. And imperialism is the external oppression of white supremacy. And until we move beyond white supremacy, there will be no progress and there will be no emancipation for the entire world.
How do we move beyond, John? How do we move beyond this white supremacy? What's key right now?
We are living in a period of interregnum between the dying of the old world, and the coming into being of the new. The rise of China, the strategic threat of Russia, that is the new world. The sun is setting in the west and it's rising in the east. But in the period in between is a period of struggle, and it's a very dangerous period because no empire leaves the stage of history without a hard-fought struggle. And that struggle is being waged now. And I just hope that the people of Iran, of Venezuela, of Cuba, of Russia and China continue to hold the line, because people in the West of consciousness and conscience are depending on them to free us all.
And on that note, I appreciate both of you being with me on this debate. Author and political commentator Jonathan Fryer out of London and out in Edinburgh. John White, author and commentator. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another debate. I'm Marzia Hashemi, signing out for myself and other crew right here in Tehran.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The New Jersey-based climate research organization, Climate Central, released a study on Tuesday, December 1st, showing that 7,668 houses, townhomes, and apartments that are either in low-income areas or are subsidized affordable housing units are currently exposed to at least one coastal flood risk event per year, and that number is expected to triple by 2050 if fossil fuel emissions are not dramatically reduced in the coming years. We have prepared an article for you in this regard, written by Julia Conley Ryder. This article is published under the heading, Without Climate Action, Number of Low-Income Homes Affected by Flooding Projected to Triple by 2050, study shows. Stay tuned, please, for the details of this article. Climate scientists have warned for years that millions of people living in coastal areas will be increasingly vulnerable to flooding in the coming decades, one of the many risks of policymakers failing to confront the climate crisis. But a new study details how people in low-income housing are expected to face the most drastic consequences of inaction. The New Jersey-based climate research organization Climate Central released a study on Tuesday, December 1st, showing that 7,668 houses, townhomes and apartments that are either in low-income areas or are subsidized affordable housing units are currently exposed to at least one coastal flood risk event per year, and that number is expected to triple by 2050 if fossil fuel emissions are not dramatically reduced in the coming years. Analyzing maps of affordable housing across the U.S., researchers found that homes in New Jersey, New York, Massachusetts, and California are particularly at risk for flooding damage brought on by hurricanes and sea level rise. A rising tide lifts all boats is a phrase often used to articulate the idea that a prosperous economy will benefit all its participants, wrote Climate Central. But the rising tides, driven by global warming, are increasing flood threats for thousands of residents in low-income communities and neighborhoods. Flooding can wreak havoc on buildings and the residents who live in them, threatening public health and causing profound disruption to families struggling to make ends meet. Chronic or nuisance flooding can also damage cars and keep residents from getting to work, school, or medical care. Middle and high-income households are expected to be affected by flooding in the coming decades as well. But Climate Central noted that people living in affordable housing are more likely to be adversely affected, as affordable housing tends to be older and is rarely equipped with resilience-enhancing features such as flood-proofing, grid energy, or backwater valves due to the cost of such measures. Additionally, residents of affordable housing often lack the financial resources to repair, rebuild, or retreat from their housing after it is damaged by floodwaters, the group said. Flood-damaged affordable housing can have long-term consequences for residents, owners, and communities, including increased homelessness, loss of rental income that can make it difficult for housing owners to provide affordable housing, and neighborhood-level economic downturns. The study demonstrated that climate action is always a justice issue first, tweeted 350.org co-founder Bill McGibbon. We don't train our attention on these neighborhoods, but many of them are already suffering significantly from these problems. Benjamin Strauss, chief executive and chief scientist of Climate Central, told The Guardian. Since 1880, the mean sea level worldwide has climbed by about 8 inches. The rise has accelerated in some U.S. cities in the last century, increasing by about 1 foot. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA, warned in a report in August that, by the end of the century, the global sea level could rise more than 8 feet above 2000 levels, if world governments don't take urgent action to reduce planet heating greenhouse gas emissions. Last month, scientists were startled to observe that a huge swath of Arctic sea ice in Siberia had yet to begin freezing for the year, among the latest signs that policymakers are not doing enough to rapidly reduce emissions. Climate Central's study served as a reminder that major climate-related events like hurricanes aren't the only challenges we need to consider, tweeted Sarah Stanley, Director of Communications at the U.S. Green Building Council. The quieter threat of sea level rise is already crippling communities, particularly the underserved.
Good morning.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.